Welcome to Earth Matters. This is Allison Civic, Executive Director of Gila Resources Information Project, and I'm your host for today's program. The 9th annual Gila River Festival was held last week here in Silver City, and today we'll be bringing you the keynote address by author and activist Ken Brower, the son of the pioneering environmentalist David Brower. The festival was opened up by Donna Stevens, Executive Director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, and Ken was introduced by Dr. Felipe Ortego Igasca, who's scholar in residence at Western New Mexico University and also a board member of New Mexico Humanities Council, which was a major supporter for this year's Gila River Festival and of Ken Brower's keynote address. And now let's join the 9th annual Gila River Festival with Ken Brower.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Donna Stevens, and like many people in this area, I wear a couple of hats. I'm the director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, which is one of the partners in the Gila Conservation Coalition, the group that organizes the Gila River Festival. So along with the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, the other partners in the Gila Conservation Coalition are Gila Resources Information Project, or GRIP, you might know them by GRIP, and Center for Biological Diversity. This year, our theme is The Gila River is in Our Hands. And at this point, I have to give a very special thanks to some Aldo Leopold High School students, because they are the ones who came up with that name and were gracious enough to let us borrow that as our theme. And those students are Ella Myers, Ella Jazz Kirk, Tasia Clark, and Alexis Rivera. So not only did they come up with a good theme that we wanted to borrow, they also, Ella Kirk, also wrote a petition to the Interstate Stream Commission, and about 2,000 people have signed that petition saying we do not want a diversion on the Gila River. So thank you, Ella. This year's festival is dedicated to two really good friends who we lost this spring, Jerry Neva and Rinda Metz, who a lot of you, I'm sure, know quite well. They really understood the importance of the natural world to preserving our connectedness with the earth, with other beings, and with each other. The next time you're in the neighborhood of the river, listen to the sounds of the river, and that's Jerry and Rinda talking to you. Please join me in welcoming Felipe Ortego Igasca.
Thank you. Gracias. Kenneth Brower is someone who I have great admiration for. And tonight's presentation by Kenneth Brower is Helping Water Win. And I like the aphorism that attends the title here. It says, by Lao Tzu, says water conquers by yielding. It never attacks, but always wins the last battle. I'd like to read some of the background for Kenneth Brower. He's the son of the pioneering environmentalist David Brower. He writes for the Atlantic, Audubon, National Geographic, Paris Review, Smithsonian, Sierra, Islands, and many other magazines. I've never written for these magazines. His emphasis has been environmental issues and the natural world, and his field work has taken him to all the continents. He's the author of The Starship and the Canoe, Wake of the Whale, A Song for Sahuatl, Realms of the Sea, The Winemaker's Marsh, Freeing Keiko, The Wilderness Within, I was just looking at that book out there, and many other books. He lives in Berkeley, California, and tonight we're going to be honored with as I understand it, you're going to be honored with a three-part harmony by all voices by Kenneth Brower. And while I didn't have a chance to ask him, I suspect that in this three-part harmony, Mama sings bass and Kenneth sings tenor. Please help me to welcome him, Kenneth Brower.
I really want to just talk about environmentalism and flowing rivers and how they come together. how they connect. I don't think it's generally understood the role that the fight for free-flowing rivers has played in just the whole environmental movement. And I sort of like to consider past history and also where the future in regards to this connection. There's a lot of debate over when the environmental movement began. A lot of loose talk, actually. A lot of people who weren't there and don't really know what happened have chimed in. I, on the other hand, at the moment, have been there long enough to know what really happened. So I'm in a position to tell you. A lot of people point to Earth Day in 1970. Gaylord Nelson and all the students who put that together. That's way, way too late as a point of origin for this movement. Too much good work had gone before that to have Earth Day count. Earth Day was like a consolidation of gains, and it was like a celebration of what we'd accomplished. But a lot of good work had been gone on before that. People mentioned the publication of Silent Spring, and that was as sort of being the beginning. In 1961, first in the New Yorker, and then as Rachel Carson's book. Tremendously important book in the history of environmentalism. Slapped us in the face, the American public woke us up to what was going on. Still, I think it's still a little too late. It doesn't do justice by the work that went before. You know, there's a very strong argument to be made for what happened right here in New Mexico and what Aldo Leopold did in establishing the first wilderness in the Gila Wilderness. There's a really good case to be made for that as being the beginning. The problem with that is, of course, they've had a precursor moment in Arizona. I think maybe the Arizonans might argue that it began in that really famous episode when Leopold, who described himself as a trigger-happy young forester, shot the mother wolf. And it's what they did in those days. People did it without thinking. I think probably the most famous line in all of Leopold's work is his account of what happens when he comes on this mother wolf he shot, and I watch the fierce green fire die in her eyes. And it's a wonderful quote. And Leopold himself marked that as sort of the turning point in his own thinking about the land and wildlife. And that might be the inception of the movement. You could argue that. I did a book, it's actually out there in the hallway, I did a book with a photographer friend on an illustrated version of San County Almanac, where we actually went out, the photographer and I, we lived in the shack in Wisconsin, in the sand hills, those old glaciated sand hills where Leopold and his family had their farm. And it was great, because it was living in the place where he'd actually done a lot of the writing, and it was you got the feeling you could sort of absorb some of this by osmosis. And it's one of the places he worked on the very important thing he did on the land that he was not only a good sort of nuts and bolts guy who knew how to get it politically done, as he did with the Gila Wilderness, but he was also a guy who could present the idea of wilderness, which is really, it's really as important as this kind of political skill, because it's a tough idea to sell, and it's an idea we need, I think we're beginning to lose again. But he gave us a framework, an ethical framework, in his land ethic for how to think about the land. So that would very well have, Sand County Almanac and Round River Journals might really have been the beginning. It was wonderful to live in this place. The shack they had left, you reached up on the shelf, or it was on the mantle above the fireplace, and there were his bird bands were still there that Leopold had used, and there was his handwriting, which was a sort of a direct connection to this wonderful period and this important period. But I think Leopold was a little too early, actually, because Leopold seemed to be the source of the origin of the movement, because Leopold really was a man. He was not a movement. He was there at the beginning, but he was working in the Forest Service and then as a teacher in government. So I don't think that's the best date to pick. There's a big school of historians, environmental historians, who point to the to the battle against the two dams and Dinosaur National Monument, the successful battle against those two dams and Dinosaur as being the real beginning of modern environmentalism. And it was the first time that a citizen group in American history stopped a big government project. It was an epical event. I am in favor of this theory, partly because my father led the campaign. So it's a little bit personal. But I watched it as a little boy, and my father and Howard Zahnheiser of the Wilderness Society really put this campaign together. And it did change the way environmentalism worked in this country. I should remind everybody who my father was. He would have been 101 this year. We had a centennial last year. And he died in 2088. But he was the first executive director of the Sierra Club. He built it, this was 1952 when he was appointed. He built it from an organization of 7,000 members, mostly sort of a hiking fraternity, to 70,000 before he left. The Sierra Club kicked him out. This was a pattern in my father's life. Every 17 years he would get kicked, his board would kick him out. He was too radical for them, and he was not attentive enough to the bottom line. He didn't mind operating in the red. He liked it, you know. He said, geez, we're not doing it, you know. The bottom line is how much wilderness we're saving. It's not whether we're going under financially. This is not what boards of directors like to hear. And so the club kicked him out. He immediately founded Friends of the Earth, which went international, and 60 or 70, I forget the count now, international sister organizations. And he founded, in that period, the John Muir Institute, League of Conservation Voters, which were all sort of under the umbrella of the John Muir Institute. But then, after 16 years, the Friends of the Earth Board kicked him out. For the same reason, he was too radical for them, and he didn't pay enough attention to his accounting. But, you know, he was like a cicada, and I'm reminded of it as I'm walking the ditch. You know, all these males working their little timbals, vibrating their little membranes. That was my old man. Not just that he made a lot of noise, which he did, but it was this life cycle. You know, after about 17 years in one of these organizations, he would begin to feel the bureaucracy grow around him. He'd have managers telling him what to do and CFAs telling him he couldn't spend money. So he would burrow to the surface and get up on a leaf, and he would split his skin of his nymph, and he would spread his wings, and he'd fly off and start a new organization. And this was his pattern. The last one was Earth Island Institute. He didn't live long enough to get fired from that one. Plus, they didn't. I think they didn't want to fire him one more time. Earth Island has got I'm on the board. It's got projects in 60 or 70 countries, or about 60 countries now, plus lots in the United States. So he was good at. It's funny. He was good at. He always felt he needed an organization, but he really wasn't an organization man. He did not fit the mold, and that's why he broke out of it so many times.
We'll be right back after this short break with Ken Brower's keynote address at the 9th Annual Gila River Festival. Welcome back to Earth Matters. We're here today with the keynote address at the 9th Annual Gila River Festival. Ken Brower's talking about his dad, David Brower, the pioneering environmentalist.
He was nominated three times for the Nobel Prize. He didn't ever win that one. He won the Blue Planet Prize, which is something that's put out by Asahi Glass Company. I went with him to Japan to pick up this award, and $500,000 that went with it. And it was a great occasion. We were in the Imperial Hotel. It was beautiful. They all loved my old man. But back on the plane, I was carrying this huge trophy, a big glass thing and titanium or something. But I was thinking about $500,000. I said, Dad, you know, your wife needs round-the-clock care now. He was in his mid-80s then, or his early 80s. And, you know, you might want to think about your grandchildren's college fund. You know, you have poverty-stricken kids. Your professor, my sister's a professor, doesn't make a ton of money, and I'm a semi-starving writer. I'm not writing sex novels or blockbusters. I'm dad. I'm thinking to myself, I didn't actually say this to him, but I'm writing environmental stuff, and I'm writing natural history, just like you wanted me to, just like you've been teaching me to do from the cradle. So what about the college funds for your grandkids? And he said, he piled every dime back into the movement. And when I sort of complained, he said, well, there's not going to be education for anybody on the dead planet. This was one of his lines. I think he was the greatest evangelical this movement ever had. There was no audience too small. Our family dinner table, you know, four poor little kids and his wife. He's working on us. Every night, not just occasionally, every night, he's practicing on us, but he's also getting us into this movement. He drafted everybody into the movement. He would come home from school. I came home with something, and he would hijack every conversation and turn any issue into this environmental subject. He lived and breathed this stuff. I came home once from junior high with a quote I liked. It was from Carlyle, I think. It was, whatever is right. And my father said, yes! And he turned that into nature is, whatever is in nature is right. And it was, on the one hand, it was kind of exasperating to have him take over every conversation this way. But at the same time, it was exhilarating because passion is a great commodity. And it was never dull at our dinner table. We were always learning these things. But in just back to this, I'm getting back to flowing water. And this in this dinosaur battle in the early 50s, he had just become the executive director of the Sierra Club, the first one. And he really invented the prototypic environmental campaign. He had slideshows, he had movies, he did grassroots organizing. He lobbied in Washington on this issue. He took Sierra Club parties, groups down the Yampin Green, the rivers or the border of the Utah and Colorado, where these two proposed dams were to go, with the idea that you have to show people the country that's at risk. You have to build a constituency for these places. Or the miners, the loggers, the extractive interests will get them. You have to have people who care about these places. And this was a big part of his campaign. I went down when I was 8 in 53, went down the Yampin Green with him. My brother Bob was 6, so he got us on one of these Sierra Club trips. He was a mountaineer. He wasn't a river guy. He dressed for the river like he would for the mountains. He wore combat pants. The war is just 7 years older. Combat pants from World War II that he'd worn in the 10th Mountain Division when he was fighting in Italy. And that's where he was when I was born, in late 44. We used all the old World War II gear. We had this World War II sleeping bags, terrible bags. Little World War II rucksacks, this little iron bar in the back. Does anybody remember those? And, I mean, I'm sure it crippled more GIs than the Germans. In fact, they did. There was horrible nerve injuries from those packs. We didn't know. As a kid, I thought they were great packs. The packs we have today, they're dreams, the little things you adjust and get it just right. Anyway. He was afraid of water. This is one of the funny things about my dad. He did not like, supposedly he'd almost drowned when he was a kid. I'm not even sure this is true. It's one of the stories people tell. But he was kind of afraid of water. He always wore his life jacket. It's funny because he was an elite climber, one of the best of his generation. He was made the first to ascend Shiprock here in New Mexico. I think he was the first guy on top of Shiprock. Won a Bronze Star in World War II, but he didn't like the water. He was afraid of the water. And everybody
sort of noticed this after a while. Everybody started wearing their life jackets too, but sure, just to make him feel better. But this is not to say that he did not love these rivers, and he absolutely fell in love with canyon country, and he knew that that this was very important. And he actually made his name. He made his bones, as we say in mafia, by killing dams on the Colorado Plateau. And it's really what made him famous, is not just Dinosaur, but his campaigns against dams in Grand Canyon were what made him a national figure. And he loved rivers. He just didn't want to get drowned in them, but he loved rivers. He loved canyons. One of his books was called Let the Mountains Talk, Let the Rivers Run, which is a very nice summary of his concerns. John McPhee, in the book on my father, he wrote a book for him, three-parter in the New Yorker, that became a book called The Encounters with Yair Shakur, about my dad and three national enemies. He's talking about Floyd Dominy and the Dominy section of the book, and they're talking someplace here in the Southwest. Somebody from the back of the room says, shouts at him, why are you conservationists always against everything? And my father said, well, if you're against something, you're for something. If you're against a dam, you're for a river. I mean, rivers are really crucial to his way of thinking. I think it would be sort of instructive for people in this room with your particular concerns on the Gila and the West to sort of remember what the beginnings of this movement were like. When my father was appointed executive director in 1952, he was only the second full-time employee of the Sierra Club. There was a woman named Virginia Ferguson who was the secretary. She wasn't sure they really needed an executive director, and it frowned on it. But so my father was only the second. This is an indication of how new this movement is. So with his addition, the staff was doubled, but it was still only two people, which is it's hard for me to imagine how huge the organization is, how powerful it is now. Because there was no environmental movement yet, really, there had been no differentiation in the ranks. And my father did a little bit of everything. He was the staff photographer in a way. He made films. He lobbied. He was CEO. He was a pamphleteer. He was an ad maker. He had to do all these things because nobody else was there to do them. And because he had to do them, he did them very well. He almost unbelievably well. Because he had to. And it's always seemed to me an interesting lesson to smaller outfits. The potential in even one person or even a small group of people to do a lot. And an example of his filmmaking. He made these 16mm films on the North in favor of parks in North Cascades, in favor of the dinosaur fight. One day, he'd just gotten out of Sierra Club board meeting. Phil Hyde, his standby photographer, ran up and said, "You've got to take the drawdown of Hetch Hetchy Dam in Yosemite. It's 180 feet. The bathtub ring looks just awful. 880 feet of bathtub ring." He said, "We got to go." So they jump in the car. They fly up to Yosemite. In one day in Yosemite, half spent in Hetch Hetchy, which is would have been another Yosemite had they not dammed it, and the half spent in Yosemite Valley, he did the whole film. He had his Sierra Club budget then allowed him about 500 feet of film. He must have shot every inch of the film. It's a pretty good movie, because it had to be a good movie. And it was not, this movie was not to save Hetch Hetchy, which at that time he thought was a lost cause. It was all directed at Dinosaur, his campaign to try to save Dinosaur National Monument. To say, we made this mistake in Yosemite, let's not make it again over here.
We'll be right back after this short break and continue with Ken Brower's keynote address at the 9th Annual Gila River Festival. Welcome back to Earth Matters. Let's hear more from Ken Brower's keynote address at the 9th Annual Gila River Festival, in which he talks about the early days of the environmental movement.
I guess all this is to say that there's some to people in this room that there's an advantage, advantage of being small and newish and underfunded and light on your feet and quick hitting and sort of unbeholden to big donors and the kind of pressure that they put on you. The kind of thing that's happened to all the bigs in the environmental movement. So it's something to remember. There's something about a smaller outfit, the passion. You can be brave. You can go at your targets. And I think that's one of the nice things in a smaller outfit. They recapitulate that early period of environmentalism when it was so hopeful and so much was accomplished. Wilderness Act, saving Grand Canyon, all the national parks were established. They were all done at a time when environmental apparatus and the size of the organizations were much, much smaller. So small groups have this power. Anyway, I think I'd just like to channel him a little bit. He's the guy who knew about this fighting for rivers. First thing he would give is, I think, to a crowd like this. I know he would, because I grew up with the guy. He would give you encouragement. He would remind people working against the human diversion that you're working in a very old, noble tradition in environmentalism, the beginning tradition, really, of these fights for rivers, a fight against the dam in Head Chichi, fight for against dams in Grand Canyon and Dinosaur. It's really where the movement began. All this really preceded environmentalism after these fights for wilderness and rivers ramified into concern about clean air, clean water, power, you know, energy, population, nuclear, all these things that the movement grew into really started with this concern. And here, of course, he'd remind you that your name is Gila, and this is where the wilderness system began. So you have this great tradition you're working in. He'd also remind you about the advantages of size, the economies of small scale I was talking about. All the trouble the bigs are having now, you can avoid. I mean, Dan's in the crowd, and I don't want to say too much bad about the Sierra Club. The Sierra Club's had a real problem lately. I don't know if you know about the 24 million that Carl Cope, the previous executive director of the Sierra Club, accepted from the gas industry in order to promote the Sierra Club's anti-coal program. Anti-coal program is a good thing, coal's bad, but you don't take under the table $24 million over a several year period. This kind of scandal it has really bothered a lot of the bigs. Nature Conservancy, wonderful outfit, and like the Sierra Club, still doing wonderful work, but getting so big that some of these corrupting influences come to play. MBAs running more and more organizations, more and more corporate influence on boards, just more people being more beholden to industry than they should be. And that's something that a small group like you guys can avoid. I think the other thing he would remind you of is this new millennium we're in. Mark Reisner in The Cadillac Desert, wonderful, probably the book on water in the West, called the 20th century the hydraulic century, called it the age of dams. And it was just this crazy period, really. It was this binge of dam building that we're all still suffering from. It was really, a lot of it was in the Depression. They were make-work projects. They were to employ people. They made no sense in the arid West, where they evaporated water. And only produce, many of them only produced power, really. They were a net deficit as far as preserving water. You lose water into the bank storage, you lose it to evaporation. It doesn't make sense. Shasta Dam, Grand Coulee, Hoover, these huge monumental, they're Egyptian. You know, they're the biggest things humans ever built. And for a while, we were all excited about that until we realized it was bad. 68,000 big dams in the United States by the end of the century. 75,000 small dams. Really only two free-flowing rivers left of any length, over 120 miles, Yellowstone and Salmon. The only undammed rivers for that length. So they did a number on us, and it wasn't just dams. It was the kinds of diversion that you're worrying about on the Gila. The Owens Valley in California just withered because Los Angeles stole the water. You know, Chinatown, the subject of the Jack Nicholson movie, Chinatown. At the end of the movie where he says, where the other cop says, it's Chinatown, Jack. Yes, it's Chinatown. It's this, the big people stealing water from the little people. It's been the story in the West. There's a change, though, because this dam building is no big dams built for a long time. Lots of little dams beginning to come out. Elwha is the in Washington is the biggest so far, the best example. Restore the salmon on the Elwha. We're beginning to realize the whole nation what we lost with this kind of destruction of our rivers. All the natural services that we forgot about, that the dams ruin, salmon runs, alewife runs, riparian wildlife, flood control that makes sense. In the southeast, it was this channelization that the Army Corps did. They channelized all these rivers. We've abused our rivers terribly. There's an understanding of that now, and so there's a new era beginning. It's not going to be the age of dams. It's going to be the age of decommissioning of dams. Hetch Hetchy, I've just finished a book. It's out there in the lobby. It's a little bit quixotic, but the idea is let's get rid of that dam. That would be a hell of a dam to get rid of. Restore Hetch Hetchy Valley, the second Yosemite. Bring it back. Financially, it's going to cost. It's going to cost. You're going to have to impound the water further down. But it was a terrible decision in the first place. No sooner had they established in 1892 Yosemite Park, then they put a dam in it, and they put a big reservoir in it. So, terrible mistake. Let's rectify those mistakes. There are some good examples on this diversion thing that you guys are facing. One is Mono Lake. And again, it's a small group. It's David Gaines, small group of friends from the Mono Lake community. And they take on Los Angeles. Los Angeles has been, just like they killed the Owens Valley, drove all the ranchers out. It's a dust bowl now. It's unhealthy because of the alkali storms you get there. They were doing the same thing with Mono Lake, this beautiful desert lake right out when you get out of Yosemite on the 120. The lake, as the level went down, as it was, as the lake was being drained, the islands were being, as the breeding islands for the birds were becoming accessible to coyotes, and there was some hatchling loss and stuff. They won in the courts, this little group. That lake is coming back up again. So little groups have this power, and these forces arrayed against you often seem just insurmountable. I mean, you took big power, big oil, but that there are these victories. Pete, I have some admonitions for you all, or some advice. One, it is on compromise. Don't do it. Don't compromise. And I think this really came largely out of his Glen Canyon experience. The Sierra Club and he personally and the whole environmental movement got burned on compromising in Glen Canyon. He never wanted to do it again. His idea was that if you're an environmentalist, your job is never to compromise. You're just to fight for what you believe in as hard as you can. That way you pull the eventual compromise your way. You know, you don't do it in advance. You argue your case as hard as you can. He used to say, let the politicians work out the compromise. We pay them to do that. Your job as environmentalists is to argue just as hard as you can for what you believe in and what's right. I've been in enough of these organizations and watched them to know there's always going to be somebody in there who wants to make a deal. Happened in the Grand Canyon fights. And happened in Dinosaur. Somebody on the Sierra Club board, there was a couple of guys who said, we can't fight these guys. It's the Bureau of Reclamation, this tremendous power. Let's give them this dam if they won't do this one. You know, this kind of deal making. Don't do that. Don't ever do that as an environmentalist. I guess the greatest story of that is on Glenn. My father believed that it was his fault that we lost Glen Canyon and that Lake Powell was built. And it was, the situation was this. He had this, the Sierra Club was fighting all for the entire upper Colorado River storage project. My father believed they could stop all those dams. And he was in Washington, and he had marshaled what he thought. He was keeping tabs of the votes. he was a good lobbyist. He knew how to count votes. And he thought he had the number to stop the whole thing, all four dams. At the eve of the vote, he gets a telegram from the Sierra Club Executive Committee saying, we are gonna, if they quit on these two dams, we'll give them these other two dams. And my father was stunned. He was fighting there in Washington. He was completely undercut by the ex-con of the Sierra Club. He was so stunned, he actually just sat there. And he thought afterwards, if I had only flown right back to San Francisco, if I convened the whole board and explained that we're within a range of stopping this whole thing. But you always have people like this. Like, I can name these people on the board. They were people who liked PG&E, our utility, and who didn't like, who insisted my father not be rude when he talked to government officers and not impugn their motives. And they had a policy, actually. He can't say bad things about government officials. Can you imagine in the environmental fight nowadays? This is what this Sierra Club wanted. So there were these people, and they were on Dick Leonard, there was Will Seary, there were these people on the board who completely cut it out from under him. And there are always guys who want to do this, but don't let them make deals like that. And this is other thing that happens, I think, is finally your organization gets successful. And you're actually rubbing elbows with congressmen and senators. And you say, wow, you know, congressman, senator. And you begin to think, geez, I better moderate my tone. I better start making nice. And I've seen this too. I think I see this happening with a wonderful group that's trying to restore Glen Canyon. They're doing wonderful work, but there's a little too much. Let's deal with these guys. Instead of, you know, you're supposed to just, you know, that's what you're supposed to do. The sort of an allied thing on reasonableness. Don't be reasonable. He had this wonderful quote he used to use. Judge Train, Russell Train, who was Nixon's EPA director, said of my father, thank God for Dave Brower. He makes it so easy for the rest of us to appear reasonable. And my father loved that quote. He used it all the time. You know, it was, to him, it was the greatest compliment. And then he riffed on it. He said, this is what Judge Train says about me. Now, what we need is people like Dave Foreman, your own Dave Foreman in New Mexico, to make me look reasonable. And then what we need after that is somebody to make Dave Foreman look reasonable. And that's right. We don't need to be reasonable. We need to be adamant in this movement. Same for objectivity. My father didn't believe in objectivity. He didn't think it existed, and I think he's probably right. He said, so why, if it doesn't really exist, should you pretend that you're objective? Don't pretend to be objective. And he's right. And then the other one was sort of on emotion. Be the emotional. There's a lot of feeling, there's a lot of criticism, oh, you're environmentalists, you're such emotional things. Good. You be an emotional thinker. You do have to know the nuts and bolts. You know, if you're talking water in the West, you have to know evaporation rates. You have to know bank storage and bank loss. You have to know about silt aggregation upstream. All these things that you need to know to talk about it. But that doesn't often swing the campaign. You've got to be right on that. There's a great example from the dinosaur story. My father, who's a sophomore dropout. Because he was a climber, he went to the mountains, he was a climbing bum for his 20s, then came down from the mountains and did good stuff. But he looked at these figures for evaporation. Burek was in order to encourage the site they wanted in Dinosaur, the two sites, they were trying to diminish the suitability of other sites by exaggerating the evaporation rates in those sites. My dad, who is a very sharp guy, very high IQ, was really good at math, looked at those figures and they looked wrong to him. And he did some calculations and he said, these figures are screwed. And I'm gonna go back and tell them. And my mother said, Dave, they're engineers back there. Don't make a fool of yourself. They have slide rules. So my dad ignored my mother, and he went back there, and he testified. These engineers for the Bureau of Records are crazy. And they're wrong, these numbers are wrong, and here's why. And Wayne Aspinall, I don't know if anybody remembers him, great old adversary of my father's on all environmental issues in the West. Looked at my father and said, you, a layman, are presumed to judge the work of the engineers of the Bureau of Reclamation. My father said, I finished ninth grade and I know how to do arithmetic. And over the next 2 days, he had some blackboard duels with these engineers and he just whooped them. He just whooped them. And was it, what is the Salt Lake paper? The Tribune, Salt Lake Tribune? Whatever the Salt Lake paper was, it awarded the Bureau of Reclamation a rubber side rule for their inability in this area. And that did have a lot to do, actually, with defeating those famous dinosaurs. Just how bad the Bureau of Reclamation looked. But it also was the emotional thing. I mean, our strong point is a deep emotion that these places have for us. And for other people, if we explain it right to them.
We'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Earth Matters. Let's hear more from Ken Brower's keynote address at the 9th Annual Gila River Festival and hear more stories about Ken's dad, legendary environmentalist David Brower, and questions from the audience.
There's another story. Tell another story. From the Grand Canyon fights, on the ads. The Grand Canyon ads, the Sierra Club ran four big New York Times, full-page, expensive ads against the dams that were going to be built in Grand Canyon. Then one of them, the most famous one, was should we also flood the Sistine Chapel so tourists can get closer to the ceiling? and the guys who did the gerrymander who did the ads, my dad wanted to do it himself. He wanted to do it all himself, and he thought he was a good writer. He was, but they had what they call a split run at the Times, where you could try two different versions. And he tried his version, did okay. One coupon you sent into Secretary Udall, I guess. Another version that the pros did, gerrymander, gossip. I'll pull my dad 3-2. He said, okay, you guys do it from now on. It was gerrymander who did the Sistine Chapel ad. And one of the things that these ads had to do, in this book I did on my dad, this Centennial book is out there in the hall, Jerry told the story of this ad, but how these ads have to work, have to have a headline that catches them. You cannot have a single sentence in that ad that loses them when you're doing an ad. And you have to keep them reading. And there's a tremendous amount of copy in those ads, much more than anybody else uses. He believed you can give them information, but you have to keep them. You can't have a single sentence that lets them go, because they're going to turn the page. And these ads were enormously effective. Udall has said this later. He said, uh-oh, something different's happening when these coupons began coming in. In addition to the letters that people wrote as they were supposed to write your own letter. This flood of ads came in. He said, there's something different happening out there. Udall, who was wrong on the dams at first, became a great environmentalist toward the end. But I'm thinking, I'm not sure ads, this is something they discovered in the course of the campaign. It was an imaginative way to get this word to people. Don't know if newspaper ads are going to work that way anymore, since newspapers are all dying. But I guess I'd ask people, activists like you, what's the next thing to have that same effect? I'll just bet you that you can come up with something. I bet there'll be some art in it, because art is so important to our movement. I'll bet it'll have something to do with finding the right language. It's always, whether you're digital or newsprint or whatever, you've got to find the right language that moves people and gets them and tells the story. And then I guess the last thing I want to say on his behalf is about the road ahead, about the future. This is the movement where you never get to rest on your laurels. You know, I forget who said it, but the line about the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. It's really true of the biosphere. It's really true of intact ecosystems. You have to be on top of the bad guys, because they have so much power. My dad used to say, they only have to win once, the exploiters, the loggers and the miners and stuff. Once they've got that site, they're going to trash it. They only have to win once. We have to win every time. And he said, for example, you defeat a dam. Good, you defeated the dam. The dam site is still there down in the canyon. It's there, it's waiting. it's waiting for somebody, a Floyd Downey type, a new viewer red type, to say, hey, global warming, we're gonna have to put a dam in there. So the point is, the fight is never over for people on our side. So I guess I'd say, you know, if that kind of prospect of never-ending fight is bleak for you or discourages you, then you should do something else. And then I would say, good luck to you. Thanks. Should we open it to questions, or?
Just a quick observation. It's always been my feeling that David Brower single-handedly dragged the Sierra Club kicking and screaming into the realm of environmental activism, and he got fired for it.
I think that's true, and a lot of people didn't want to go that way.
Yeah.
A lot of people wanted it to be a hiking club. Every once in a while, I kind of wished, when I thought about my, it would have been great if he stayed at the Sierra Club. He loved the Sierra Club, still loves the Sierra Club. After he got fired, he became a director, and would get mad at them and quit, and then he would get hired again. He ran for president once, didn't work. But he grew up in the Sierra Club. The Sierra Club formed him. He formed the Sierra Club. I mean, it was, he loved it. He and Adams worked, when he was a young man, really led the fight that Sierra Club led to establish Kings Canyon National Park in the Sierra. So he grew up in that organization. But there were people who didn't, they didn't like the turmoil. And there was some, I tell some of the stories in the book, sometimes I wished he'd been a little bit better at mending his fences. And if he backed off just a little bit, and because it would have been wonderful if he'd stayed with that outfit. But then, in doing this book, I sort of reacquainted myself with the history. I'll just tell you one story. Young man, another example of how one person can do something. Young man worked for him, a forester, briefly, at the Sierra Club, named David Pessin. I thought, so why don't you go out and look at this reactor they're going to build at Bodega. Pessin went out and said, whoa, this is something fishy out here. He went down to PG&E, the utility, and he went to the secretary and said, I'm interested in this PG&E thing. What can you tell me about it? She said, well, here's the file. And the PG&E secretary gave him the file. You can't imagine this happening now. It was full of collusion between a county government and the utility. And so Pessin's organized resistance there, among the ranchers up there, Bodega Head, where this reactor's gonna build. It's gonna be the biggest reactor in the world. It was right on the San Andreas Fault. Mm-hmm. The Tamales Bay, if you know the layout, it's this long straight bay. It is the San Andreas Fault. It's the surface market that went right through that site. This is the way these people were thinking then. And so Pessman says, gets this group together, organizes them, and he goes in. The executive committee of the Sierra Club hears about this, and they call him in. And they say to him, and he says, I think we can stop this thing on the grounds of public safety. And Dick Leonard, one of my father's old nemesis at the club, lawyer, his wife worked for PG&E in the end, got up and passed in his face and shook his finger at him and said, don't you dare talk about public safety. The Sierra Club is about wilderness preservation. It's about wildlife. We don't do public safety. And shook his finger in his face. And Pessin said, what? And walked out and by himself, with this small group of people, stopped this huge, potentially catastrophic reactor by himself. It's a big hole in the ground now. They call it a duck pond. The ducks go there. So, but that's the kind of thing I remember my father had to deal with. And lots of stories like that, like the way he was undercut on Glen Canyon. People just didn't have the balls and the ovaries and everything that they needed.
And I had a copy of that Sistine Chapel ad on my office bulletin board for several years.
Hi, I was just wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about your work, maybe a recent project that you've been working on with imagination or activism.
I've got a a book I've been working on for a few years on the low islands I know that are going to be gone. I was supposed to talk about global warming. I didn't very much. But climate change, you know, we're suffering from it. We've got these floods and these fires. We're having horrible ones in California, as you guys know. So we're suffering. But these are people who live 7, 8, 15 feet above sea level on low coral atolls and islands. And a lot of my work has been in these places, underwater for National Geographic and books on whales and stuff. And Republic of the Marshall Islands, an old U.S. protectorate. Republic of the Maldives, Kiribati Nation, large parts of the Federated States of Micronesia. These republics are going to be gone. These are nations that aren't going to exist. And so my book is really, I don't argue global warming, I just try to describe these places I know. These people are all wonderful people. You asked about the tribes. In the central Carolina Islands, there are two little atolls. One is 7 feet above sea level, one is 15 feet above sea level, where they practice the last traditional celestial navigation that once colonized the whole Pacific. And these people are, these men, you cannot believe these men, 30-year, no women, sorry, not off limits to women. These men spent 30 years in apprenticeship learning through mnemonic chants, the star courses, they call them, from each pair of islands in their whole system. So that takes them 30 years to navigate by the stars at night, that swell by day. The swells are arriving from four different directions at the same time. They have to know what their dominant swell is, east swell mostly. In some cases, great navigators in the Pacific have been blind men because it's the motion of the swell. When a guy is really in doubt about which swell he's feeling, and he wants to feel most, he puts his testicles on the gunwale. That's his best seismic equipment to feel that thing. And these people, they have target expansion techniques that are extraordinary. What kind of bird is flying, what direction, when? They describe phenomena that the Western science doesn't even know. It's a weird thing. There's this thing called a deep phosphorescence that all Pacific navigators tell you about, whether they're Polynesian or Melanesian or Micronesian. 100 miles from the island that you're going to, you begin to see this glow under the sea. It gets brighter as you get closer. It's like you're getting warmer, warmer. And you listen to this and you say, what could this possibly be? Nobody knows. It's not normal surface phosphorescence. It's something happening deep. It's something the island is sending out. It's got to be true because they all say it. Nobody, no Western scientist says anything about what this is. So anyway, these are extraordinary peoples. And every one of these places has capabilities like that. Until you spend a day with a traditional spear fisherman who never listens. It's not like baseball. You know, the spear fisherman, fish is moving in all directions. Anyway, these are remarkable people. And I'm trying to describe what they've got and what's going to be going. And books on, I got lots of stuff going. I got a coyote piece on there. There's a wonderful woman named Camilla Fox, one of our Earth Island projects. She's studying non-lethal methods of coyote control. It's going to be a hard sell here, I've been told, for dinner tonight. But it's working in sort of the boutique ranches in Marin County. They told Wildlife Services, kill 5 million animals a year on our public lands. Told them, sorry, we don't need you. We're going to do it with guard llamas, guard Great Pyrenees, these guard, wonderful guard dogs, Tibetan Mastiffs, all these dogs that your tribal people have figured out how to watch their sheep with. We're going to do that. Wildlife Services doesn't work. Shooting, trapping, poisoning coyotes produces more coyotes because of reproductive strategy of coyotes. These people in Marin County, where I live, don't lose any animals with these guard dogs. So that's a wonderful story. There's all kinds of good stuff if you want to do media stuff on the environment to write about.
All right. Well, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us today for Ken Brower's keynote address at the 9th Annual Gila River Festival. For more information on the fight to save the Gila River, visit gilaconservation.org. We hope you'll join us again for next week's edition of Earth Matters here on Gila Mimbres Community Radio.